So today is an event, part of a series called Questions for Life, which is an annual opportunity for people in Canary Wharf to engage with some of the big questions of life and to hear the good news about Jesus. So it's organised by St Peter's Barge and the Christian Workplace Fellowships like the one at Barclays. The Barge, St Peter's Barge, is on West India Quay, so it's been around for 17 years now in the wharf, serving those who work in Canary Wharf. So our speaker today, Andrew Satch, is Reverend Dr. Andrew Satch. So he is both a Church of England vicar and an academic doctor, so a PhD in science, I believe, audiology. He's going to speak on does the resurrection matter today? And then he will take questions at the end. So without further ado, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcus, and thank you for tuning in this lunchtime. I think I'm more smartly dressed than most of you. I can't see most of you on your webcams, but I guess this isn't the average working from home gear. But actually, I'm dressed like this because this morning I went to my next door neighbour's funeral, and it's rather an appropriate backdrop, maybe. Funerals are very sad things, as I watched a granddaughter struggle to get through a reading as tears in her eyes, and it makes it a rather wonderful time for me to be able to think about the resurrection of Jesus, which changes everything. And I'm glad for the opportunity to share that with you. The news of the Easter morning, those 2,000 years ago, begins like this in Luke's eyewitness account. He says, on the first day of the week at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared, and they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And as we read on, we discover Jesus appearing to people alive and the beginning of that great Christian news that were to shake and rock the world, that Jesus had risen from the dead. And my talk on why that matters used to be a very short one. It went like this: death is a horrible thing, self-evidently. I certainly feel that, having been to a funeral this morning. Death is horrible, and therefore a resurrection is wonderful. Because if Jesus rose from the dead, then the claim that Christians make that death isn't the end has real evidence behind it. It's not just wishful thinking. Wouldn't it be nice to imagine that there could be life after we die? But it's actually a matter of historical precedent. If Jesus died and came back, it stands to reason it's possible for other people to die and then come back from the dead. Rico Tice, who wrote the Christianity Explored course and the Life Explored course, I think, both that run at St. Peter's Barge from time to time. He gives the analogy of being in the queue for the school nurse waiting for the BCG vaccine. Maybe in your day it was MMR or whatever cocktail of vaccinations. And even though he was quite a big rugby playing bloke, he was terrified of needles. And as he was waiting in the queue, shuffling forwards towards the nurse's door, he decided to try and let rationality trump his fears. And he decided to watch the person in front of him in the queue, a small weedy kid, let's call him Andrew. And as they shuffled forward, Andrew went into the nurse's office, the door closed, and Rico said, I watched very, very carefully. I listened carefully. I could hear no blood-curdling screams coming from the other side of the nurse's door. I thought, that's a good sign. I looked down at the gap between the door and the floor. I saw no pool of blood seeping under the door. I thought, that's a good sign. But then Rico said the clincher was when the door opened and this weedy kid, Andrew, comes out with a little plaster on his arm, smiling. And Rico says to himself, if he can get through, I can get through. You see, there was evidence that school vaccinations are survivable. And Jesus' resurrection is real evidence that death is survivable. You can come back. That used to be my talk, and that could be my talk today, and we're over and done with just in 5 minutes. But actually, that isn't quite the way that the story is presented in the New Testament. And that's because not everyone agrees, back in the secular first century Greek world, and not everyone agrees in our 21st century world, that death is a bad thing necessarily. People instead say, well, look, death is natural. Eventually you've had a good innings, and it would be boring, wouldn't it, if life went on too long. Even we've had people moving for legislation in Parliament to be able to choose to end your life. And if death isn't necessarily bad, then resurrections aren't necessarily welcome. That's the secularist view. Maybe we are just biological machines. Maybe after a certain number of years on this planet, it's just time for us to recycle our carbon and pass on our genetics to the next generation. Well, instead of then my original talk, death is bad, the resurrection is good news, I want to reverse the order and say the resurrection proves that life after death is a serious matter. The resurrection proves that life after death is a serious matter. And I want to take you to earlier in Luke's account of Jesus' life and a story that Jesus told. It's a made-up story, a parable, and it illustrates why a resurrection would make a big difference to how we think about life. And then in the last bit of the talk, I want to go back to Jesus' resurrection and see whether it really happened. So let me try and share with you on the screen. If you're watching, you might be able to see this. If you're just phoning in, I'm going to read it to you, this Bible passage. It's from Luke's Gospel, chapter 16. It goes like this. Jesus' story begins, "There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores." Okay, so here's a fairly extreme story about two men with very contrasting experiences of life. A rich one who lives in luxury, a poor one who is covered with disease and half starving. Two men. Jesus' story goes on. Two men, two destinies. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things and Lazarus in like manner received bad things, but now he is comforted here and you are in anguish." So this is a heaven and hell story. Two men, two destinies. And the rich man ends up in hell, in Hades. The poor man ends up in paradise. Now, Jesus isn't saying in his story that automatically being rich sends you to hell or being poor sends you to heaven. Jesus is just making up a story. But to cause us to think about what matters most, life in this world for a few short years, or life in the next world that stretches forward into eternity. And in Jesus' story, these two men have reversed fortunes. And the question is, which would you rather be? Do you see, that question, the answer to that question, depends entirely on what timescale you work to. If you were just to look at them in this life, then of course you would prefer to be the rich man, dining in the best restaurants and wearing the finest fashions, living in luxury. And nobody would want to be on the breadline and full of disease like this poor man. It's an obvious question. But then when you fast forward Jesus' story and you take into account the afterlife, you would give exactly the opposite answer. Which would you rather be? Well, of course, I would rather be in paradise than in hell. And in fact, on the timescale of eternity, the few years of luxury or poverty here and now matter so little. The only thing that matters in the end is where they end up spending the rest of eternity. There's a made-up story, but Jesus is just getting us to think about destiny. Two men, two destinies. Let me read on. Abraham says, "Beside all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." Two men, two destinies, too late. Jesus says that there is a time when our eternal destiny, heaven or hell, is fixed and you cannot cross from one to the other. And therefore, it really matters that you end up in the right one. It doesn't really matter very much whether you're rich or poor in this world. It doesn't matter if the economy tanks or not because of coronavirus. It doesn't matter whether you get ill or not in an eternal timescale. But it really, really matters where you end up forever, because it's too late to change destiny. Let me read on in the story. Then the rich man, who's ended up in hell, says, I beg you, Father, to send Lazarus, this poor man, to my father's house. I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment. But Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. Moses and the prophets is a reference to the Jewish scriptures, the first part of the Christian Bible. Let them listen to the Bible. And he said, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, then they will repent. They'll change their mind. He said to them, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. Now, it's a made-up story, but it's a very powerful story because Jesus is saying that lots of people haven't factored eternity into their plans. They're only thinking, will I get through the economic downturn that follows coronavirus? Or will I psychologically survive lockdown with my family in rather too close proximity for comfort for the next who knows how many weeks? Will I survive the next 2 weeks? Will I survive the next 10 years in business? But too few of us are thinking, but where will I end up forever? And maybe that's because you're a secularist and you just assume that when we die, we decompose and that's it. Our thoughts are only the movement of electrons. Our bodies are only assemblies of organic molecules. And in the end, we decompose and there's no memory of us forever. But that isn't Jesus' view of the world. Jesus' view of the world is there is an afterlife. And if there is an afterlife, then where you spend eternity matters more than anything else in this life. Who cares whether you wear fine linen? Who cares whether you eat at the best restaurants? Who cares whether you're poor and diseased in the light of forever? And so the man who's made this mistake in Jesus' story, he sees the need to warn everybody else. He says, my brothers, my five brothers, they are not thinking on an eternal timescale either. Please send somebody from the dead to warn them. Now, I don't know about you, I think that would be a pretty good warning. If somebody that you knew was dead, that you'd seen buried, suddenly visited you again, and I don't mean as a ghost, I mean actually flesh and blood visited you again, then they would have pretty good evidence about the afterlife. And imagine they came back and they said, look, we don't just decompose and rot. That isn't the end. Actually, there is a paradise and there is a hell. And I've come to warn you to get ready for that before you end up and it's too late. That would be good evidence, I would have thought. And Jesus, very perceptively, he disagrees with that. If people won't listen to Moses and the prophets, he says, if people have got their minds made up by their secularist ideology that they're not even open to the possibility of life beyond the grave, then even a resurrection will not convince them. Now, that is challenging, isn't it? Because Jesus is saying that even if I could prove to you, and I'm going to try and do it in a minute, actually, but even if I could prove to you that Jesus really did defeat death, come back from the grave, that would not be enough to convince many viewers of this Zoom call to take eternity seriously. Jesus knows there is a kind of closed-mindedness that is not even open to evidence. It's a kind of secular thinking. I think you find it in the works of Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins writes in The God Delusion that the resurrection cannot have happened, being in the very nature of the case a contradiction of the laws of science. It sounds quite persuasive, doesn't it? I can't believe in supernatural fantasies, he says. I'm a rational scientist. But when you think about it, it's not actually very rational at all. All it means is Richard Dawkins has an existing theory, namely, there is no God. We are only collections of carbon atoms. We're here by accident. And that theory will not be budged, irrespective of the evidence. Now, that actually isn't very scientific. All of the great scientific revolutions in the past have come because people are willing to let fresh evidence challenge their existing theory. It's not very scientific to pre-decide that there is no God and that there is no life after the grave, and then ignore evidence to the contrary. A true scientist needs to look with open mind at the evidence and then be prepared to revise the theory. Well, Jesus knows that if you're not open-minded in that way, if you've already decided that there is no God, then I'll be wasting my time for the last 7 minutes of this talk and nothing will convince you. However, I wonder whether there's some viewers today who are at least open to the possibility that there could be a God of such power that he made this universe. He is the God who made the Big Bang go bang. He is the God who designed human beings. He is the God who is grieved at the way that the world has rebelled against him and all the devastation that that has brought, all the brokenness of the world, including this virus. But there is a powerful God, and a resurrection would not be in principle impossible for him. In fact, a resurrection is exactly the kind of thing you might expect him to do to validate his son, Jesus Christ, as the King of Kings. Before I was a Christian, Jesus' miracles and Jesus' resurrection used to be a real problem for me. But now I realize that I'd have more of a problem if Jesus didn't do any miracles. Imagine I were to say to you, well, I'm glad you tuned in today because you're very privileged. I'm actually God. I'm the creator of the universe. At which point the Christian forum are a bit concerned about the speaker they've invited and thinking, who is this guy? And you would be thinking, you're God, prove it. And I said, oh no, I'm afraid I can't do anything that the rest of you can't do, but trust me, I'm God. At that point, you would not trust me. Actually, the kind of claim to be God expects some kind of extraordinary evidence. For example, a resurrection from the dead. A resurrection would be evidence that not only should we take Jesus seriously, but also that we should take life beyond the dead, beyond the grave seriously. And if there is life beyond the grave, well, then let's take our lesson from Jesus' story. This question, not of where you'll spend the next 5 years, but where you will spend the next 50,000 years and beyond. It matters more than anything else in your life. If there is a resurrection, then you ought to not be planning just on a until you're 60, 70, 80, 90 year timescale, pensions and that's it. You should be planning on an eternal timescale. So the question is, was there a resurrection? What is the actual evidence for Jesus' resurrection? And I'm going to cover this briefly because on Wednesday, even better, you have a high court judge speaking on a call. You'll find the address for that on the Questions for Life website, and I think Marcus will tell you about it a little bit later. But just in anticipation of some of the evidence on Wednesday, in case you can't tune in, here's a little bit of the evidence of Jesus' resurrection being a real historical fact. And I'm reading from the final chapter of Luke's eyewitness biography. As they were talking about these things, actually they're talking about the claim some of the disciples have made to have seen Jesus alive. As they were talking about the reports of Jesus' resurrection, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace to you." But they were startled and frightened, and they thought they saw a spirit or a ghost. Now, I want you to notice at this point that the disciples are not just these sort of credulous, primitive people who don't know the difference between death and life. They know as well as we do that when someone dies, you do not see them again. You don't need to know that much science to realize that. You just have to bury a few generations of people in your village. And they knew that when someone dies, you never meet them again. And then here is Jesus, who they watched executed and they saw being buried. And now he's in the room with them. And of course, they are frightened. It's not a sort of fairy story, is it? They were just rejoicing and happy and smiley. They were terrified. This is not supposed to happen. And then they rationalize it. Maybe we're hallucinating. Maybe this is just a spirit, a ghost. Jesus said to them, "Why are you troubled? Why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see. A spirit or ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they were still disbelieving for joy and were marveling, he said to them, "Have you anything to eat?" They gave him a piece of fish and he took it and ate it before them. Now, this is what I call the ghost test. And it goes like this. If you meet somebody in the middle of the night, in your bedroom, and you're wondering to yourself, is this my husband or wife? Or is this a ghost? Here are two ways that you can check. It's probably pretty obvious to you already, but here are two ways of verifying that. The first one is the touch me and see test. Now, this doesn't really work on Zoom. If I was here in real life with you, I would get somebody to the front and see if they're a ghost by touching them. And I can, you know, I reckon I'm real, but of course this could just be a ghost broadcast. But if there's somebody else in lockdown with you, then maybe after this call, you could go and just touch them just to verify. It's actually a very good test, isn't it, of whether you're just hallucinating somebody or whether they're really there. Does your hand meet physical resistance when you grab hold of their shoulder? But Jesus doesn't just say, why didn't you touch me? Jesus says specifically, touch my hands and my feet. And that's a reference, I think, to the scars of the form of execution, of crucifixion, with which the Romans killed Jesus. They would drive nails through the hands, through the wrists, and sometimes also through the feet. And so by inviting them to touch his hands, not only is it a way of verifying that he is alive, but they can also verify that the person who is alive is the same as the person that was executed. So kind of double check. And that's the first one, the touch test. And the second one is the eat something test. And this one I really can show you. I haven't got any broiled fish, but I do have a hot cross bun. And you'll notice as I eat it, a bit of the bun has actually disappeared. Now, I suggest if I was a ghost and I eat it, unless I had lots of CGI, a bit of bun would, I guess, just drop to the floor. If even I had the strength to break it off with my ghost teeth, which I probably wouldn't have. But food actually disappearing into my mouth and disappearing is another sign that I'm a real person. And by all means, do the same test with your housemate afterwards, after this video. It's a silly illustration, but here's my point. Jesus meets people who are not predisposed to believing in resurrections. They're actually terrified, they're startled, they're confused. But then Jesus gives them concrete evidence that he really is alive. They touch him and he eats in their presence. And as a result, they are sure that they have met the Lord and King of the universe. Only God could do something like this. This sort of thing doesn't ordinarily happen. The resurrection means that we should take Jesus seriously, but the resurrection also means we should take death seriously. Death is not, therefore, just the decomposition of a body into its constituent chemicals. And death is the beginning of the next phase of our existence. And in Jesus' story, he warns us that there are two destinies. There is a heaven and there is a hell. He warns us that when you get there, it's too late to change places. And so Jesus urges us to pay attention to his resurrection as a sign that we ought to be thinking about our own destiny forever. Where are we going to end up? And then Luke's gospel ends wonderfully with these words. I'm afraid I don't have them for the slide, but I'm going to read them to you. But Jesus then said to them, "These are my words I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets in the Jewish Bible, all the prophecies about me must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, "This is what's written, that the Christ should suffer." It's a reference to Jesus' death on the cross on Good Friday. "The Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead." It's a reference to that glorious resurrection on the first Easter Sunday. And he says that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning with Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. Jesus' resurrection not only means that there are two destinies, but Jesus' resurrection means that for those who trust Jesus, there is a sure way to be forgiven, to change destiny from somebody headed to hell, like the rich man in Jesus' story, to somebody certainly headed for paradise. Repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. And coronavirus matters, the economy matters, but your eternity means it matters even more than that. Jesus' resurrection means that if you trust him, you can side with him and be on the way to paradise, forgiven.
Could you just tell us, as we wait for questions, just briefly how you came to faith in Christ yourself?
I was a sort of religious though sceptical. So I'd grown up going to church. I was in the church choir in my town. But by the time I was a teenager, 16, 17, I was pretty sceptical. And I was reading Richard Dawkins and so on. So I thought religion was just this kind of human construct that helped us in society, but I didn't think it was true. Went to university, I met some Christians who really followed Jesus, and it really changed their lives, and they thought about it very carefully, and they gave me lots of answers that the questions I had. And gradually I started to realize this is historical, and it's evidence-based, and it's rationally coherent in a way that I began to realize my atheism wasn't. And the final piece of the jigsaw for me was not, is it true, but is it good? Because I just had this idea that God was out to wreck my life, and I was best avoiding him. And the final thing I had to be persuaded of was, this is true and it's good. Some questions are arriving, and let me take them in order. So somebody writes, is there any non-biblical evidence for the life and resurrection of Jesus Christ? Thank you. And there is some. There are references to Jesus in Roman writings like Tacitus, and in Jewish writings like Josephus, of, contemporary of the time. But there's not much. And let me explain a bit why that is. In the first century, there were no such thing as books. People wrote on parchments and they rolled them up in scrolls. And there was only so long that you could make a parchment and only so big that you could make a scroll. So books were of limited length, also documents were of limited length. And then around about the third century, people invented books. They said, why don't we stitch scrolls down the middle and fold them and have pages? That's a great breakthrough. And it also meant that you could compile together an anthology of lots of documents into a much bigger document. And so people went around saying, well, we're interested in all these sources about Jesus Christ. Why don't we collect together into one place all of the relevant sources about Jesus that come from the first century? And so that's what they did. And that's our New Testament. So the New Testament is really an anthology of originally separate documents that are collected because they give us relevant evidence about Jesus' death and resurrection. So asking, is there any non-biblical evidence, is actually like saying, is there any evidence outside the anthology? And the answer is there's a little bit, but there's not much, because they did a really good job in making sure that everything relevant went into the anthology. Another question. Your talk assumes that the Bible's true, but how can we know that? Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. And that's a talk for another time. And I'd love to talk about that on Zoom, or somebody else can sometime soon. But you're right that that's really worth checking out, because the claims of the New Testament about Jesus' death and resurrection are life-changing claims, and you ought to look into it. So don't just say, oh, I don't know if it's true, and then shelve it. Take the next step logically and say, I need to find out if this is true. Very brief answer. It seems to me that the people who testified to it thought it was true. So the eyewitnesses, they were convinced. Otherwise, how do you explain their willingness to be martyred, especially when at the morning of the first Easter, they didn't even understand. They were dejected. They thought Jesus had failed. And something happened that galvanized them into a force that would change the world. And suddenly they were prepared to be persecuted for their testimony. And it seems to me that they thought it was true. But also they were the ones who were in a position to know if it's true. Sometimes people die for a lie, don't they, for a cause that is a fake. I don't think it's true that if you fly an aeroplane into a skyscraper, you're going to go to paradise. But the people who did it, the terrorists at 9/11, they thought that was true. You definitely don't die for something that you know to be a lie. Well, Jesus' first followers, they thought that the resurrection was true. But the difference is that they were also in a position to know, because they were there. They were the witnesses. They were the ones who touched Jesus, who saw him eat in their presence. That's probably a little taster, but a topic for another talk. Let me read on another question. Can you expand on how Jesus' death and resurrection is a fulfillment of scripture? Thank you. That's a really helpful question. So, do you remember this reference to Moses and the prophets, the Jewish scriptures? It comes twice in today's talk. We saw it in the story of the rich man and Lazarus, Jesus' made-up story. He said, if people won't listen to Moses and the prophets, even a resurrection won't convince them. And then in Luke 24, the last chapter of Luke's biography, at the resurrection itself, Jesus says, the law of Moses and the prophets must be fulfilled. It's this weird thing, because actually, Jesus' disciples really should have expected a resurrection. And there are various prophecies in the Old Testament, notably Psalm 16, in which the writer says that God will not abandon my body to the grave, and he looks forward to the hope of life, and various other ones. There are references to the resurrection, and so they ought to have been expecting it, not least because not only was it there in the Jewish scriptures, but Jesus in his own teaching kept predicting it. He says, I'm going to be killed, and 3 days later, I'm going to be raised to life. But the point is, and I think it's probably to our advantage as skeptics, if you are a skeptic, they didn't expect it. Maybe they weren't listening, and maybe they didn't really believe Jesus. Maybe when he died, they thought, well, how can we be sure he was right? And that means that they had to be persuaded by what they saw as eyewitnesses. But then when they see it, then the predictions and the eyewitness testimony, they then dovetail, they come together. And I think that's quite a powerful combination. If you have a promise of something, and then you have a witness to it actually happening, or several witnesses to it actually happening, that's the evidence combination that we have in the New Testament, and predicted and then fulfilled in front of eyewitnesses. I'm going to read some more questions. Let me look down. Samuel, when we're out of time, I look to you just to unmute yourself and say stop now, whenever you want to. But I'm going to keep going otherwise. Thanks so much for the talk, Andrew. You're welcome. My question is this. The Bible describes other cases of people being resurrected, Jairus' daughter and Lazarus, for example. Why is Jesus' resurrection extra special compared with these other cases? Thank you. That's obviously somebody who knows the New Testament quite well. And it is true that Jesus, in his ministry, raised people from the dead, including those two individuals you mentioned, the daughter of Jairus and a man called Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha. So all of those demonstrate Jesus' power over death. There's an interesting detail in John's account that illustrates a difference between the resurrection of Lazarus and the resurrection of Jesus. And it's all about the grave clothes. And I've actually, I wonder if I can even show you, I've actually tried to illustrate this in a post that I've made for Easter. That, yeah, okay, I don't know if you can see this on my iPad, but corpse, teenager, grave robbers, and then Easter. What happens when they go into the tomb to see Jesus' body's disappeared is they don't find a corpse. That would mean he hasn't been resurrected. They don't find a heap of clothes in a pile, which would mean, you know, he was a teenager and he got dressed in a hurry. They don't find nothing at all, which could be grave robbers. They find Jesus' clothes. If you can see that, so I had fun taking this photograph. They see Jesus' clothes just lying there with the head clothes, the hat and the body clothes sort of separated as if he'd been wearing them and his body had passed right through. That's just a little hint that Jesus' resurrection is something altogether more special than the resurrection, the raising from the dead of others. Lazarus comes back from the dead to live another human life. Jesus passes through the grave and comes up the other side with a body that is altogether different. It's still physical. They can still touch it. He can still eat things. But this is now a glorified body, and he can walk through walls. He can appear in closed rooms. And Jesus' resurrection body is not of this world. It's part of the world to come. Some clues there. Maybe I'll make this the last question. Somebody says, the idea of turning to God during this coronavirus situation does feel encouraging, but will it actually make a change to our lives once things settle down? Are you saying in this talk this is life-changing and worth it long-term? I am saying that, yeah. Let's supposing that coronavirus goes away, we get a vaccine, everyone is okay. I think the problem with that is the world will think we're fine. We're okay. We had a scrape, we had a really terrifying health situation, but we've solved it. Let's imagine it bounces back economically, everything's okay. But actually things wouldn't be okay. We'd still be a society of people like the rich man in Jesus' story, living in luxury, clothed in the finest linen, dining well. And then one day we would die and we would discover there's an eternity ahead of us, a heaven and a hell, and none of us would be prepared for it at all. Now, if this coronavirus thing causes us to reflect on our mortality in advance of the hour, in that way, it will be a good thing for us. Now, of course, there's lots of terrible things. I'm not saying coronavirus is good. It's a tragic thing. But that outcome of it might be a mercy from God for us. Because actually, beyond coronavirus, we will still be mortal. And beyond coronavirus, we'll still be facing eternity in a heaven or a hell. And just perhaps these terrible circumstances of here and now might be the prompt to think very seriously about that before the end. I really hope it is. I hope that you will take the time to look out for yourself at some of the eyewitness evidence for Jesus and ask those questions. Is this true? Is this reliable? Did this happen? Because if it did happen, then every one of us needs to think about our own eternity and that offer that Jesus makes, that if we trust in him, then we can be forgiven. We can change sides. We can be on the side of life. Thank you so much for listening. I think Ed is going to be over to you. Let me just find Ed so that I can unmute him because I have the powers to do that as host. There we are, Ed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I guess an encouragement to us to expand our time horizon and start thinking about time in an eternal aspect rather than just today. Thank you very much all for joining. It was good of you to give us your lunchtime. I hope you enjoyed what we said today. A few notes, and Andrew's mentioned some of this already. This is a talk as part of the Questions for Life series. This series is continuing next on Wednesday. And on Wednesday, Sir Jeremy Cook, who's an ex-High Court judge, is going to look at the evidence for the resurrection. The details of that can be found at the questionsforlife.org.uk website. That's questionsforlife.org.uk website. Or if you want some more details on that, you can email us at christians@barclays.com. That's christians@barclays.com. Furthermore, if maybe something today has spiked your interest or brought something new to your mind, KPMG are going to run a Christianity Explored course throughout the month of April. So if you'd like some more details on that, it's at the same website, or you can just email us and we can share some more of those details with you about what it means to be a Christian. But no, I think that's all from us today. Thank you for joining. And I think as a lot of us on this call can perhaps attest, it is really, really good to find Jesus and to find a personal relationship with our God. Thank you very much.